Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for tuning into Paranormal Talk Radio. This is not the X-Files. We are not scientists. We are not mathematicians. We are certainly not school teachers. We are no experts. We are paranormal investigators who have come together to give our audience insight and educational subjects about the paranormal field. Join us live every Friday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio. Without further delay, here are your hosts, Matthew J. Haas, and his partner in crime, Tim Vickers.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to yet another fabulous episode of Paranormal Talk Radio. I am your co-host, Matthew J. Haas. Unfortunately, my partner in crime is not with me tonight. He had something to take care of. Sometimes life can get in the way of things we love to do. However, I have a very special guest co-host tonight who's sitting here with me. Well, not physically with me, but on the other side, so to speak. He is a good friend and mentor and radio show host of Understanding the Fringe. You guys might be familiar with him. And also is an author of a great book, Even the Dead Won't Tell You the Truth. My good friend Chip Reichenfeld is here to fill in for Tim Vickers. How are you, Chip?
I'm doing great, Matt. And again, thank you for the great honor of co-hosting with you. And any chance I have to be anybody's partner in crime, you know, I mean, that's always a good thing. But, you know, if we're going to do crime tonight, we should be careful because our guest is a retired detective.
Yes, that's correct. We have a really good guest tonight. He is a retired detective. He's got a great background in law enforcement. And he's a very renowned, well-known UFO researcher all across the country, probably even the world. His name is James Clarkson. He's got a great book, and the title of the book is Tell My Story, June Crane, the Air Force and UFOs. He's got a 2015 edition out. For those who are not familiar with James Clarkson, I will give a little info about him, as I do all of our guests. Well, basically, he is the state director, Washington state director of the Mutual UFO Network, and he works closely with two very dedicated and very well-known researchers in the UFO field, Peter Davenport, the director of the National UFO Reporting Center, which is a very well-known organization for reporting UFO sightings and stuff like that, and William Puckett, the director of UFO SNW. He is an author, and like Chip said, he's got a law enforcement background, and he's been doing UFO research for a very, very long time, so I'm very excited to have him as our guest. I believe he's also worked with MUFON, from time to time, and everybody knows MUFON is a big organization that dwells into UFO research. And they network with a bunch of people. They're a large group, Chip. They work with a lot of people out there.
Yeah, I always like my MUFON guys. And he's been on and off, at least on, off, and on again. I believe he's the director for the state of Washington. Now, and you know, I first and foremost, I for one have an immense amount of respect for anybody that has been or is in law enforcement. I don't think people understand the kind of sacrifice it takes to do that job. They are literally putting their lives on the line for our communities, and they're really not receiving the kind of respect due them, and especially recently in the news, much less than they deserve. And I'm a big fan of that, you know. On top of that, I mean, you know, I I've got some friends in the UFO community. I've got some friends who have had personal experiences with extraterrestrials. And it's really not that different from our ghost people, you know, the paranormal groups.
No, not at all.
There's a certain amount of risk in coming out and admitting some things about either ghosts or UFOs or any of the supernatural types of things, you know. But when you have somebody that was in law enforcement that is really putting himself out there, you know, it says all the much more. Talking about taking risks in order to further the truth, at least as far as I'm concerned, truth, you know. And so, you know, you really have to admire the guy. And the fact that he's such a well-known guy and going to be with us tonight is a very exciting thing.
Yeah, definitely. You know, as many have been listening to our past few shows through the month of May, Chip, I don't know if you know, but we are having UFO Month throughout the entire month of May. I kind of designated it as UFO Month when we had Andrea Perron as our guest in the beginning of May.
Mm. Oh, she loves her some extraterrestrials. And
yeah.
She's had some personal experiences, and what a sweet and wonderful lady she is.
Yeah, definitely. She, you know, kind of kicked it off for us there for UFO Month, and I figured, you know, since I was having her on, I'm like, why not just dedicate the month to UFOs and aliens and all that good stuff? I've kind of been into it ever since I was a kid. I mean, who didn't love the movie, you know, E.T.?
Oh, yeah. And how well done was that?
Oh, yeah. And one of my other favorite movies, Chip, I don't know if you're a big fan of it, but I loved Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Another great one, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think also Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I liked Richard Dreyfuss, you know, back in the day. He was always kind of the everyday guy, you know, and going through some supernatural or supernormal experiences, even in some of his romantic films, you know.
Yeah.
Because he does not look like your leading man. but he did a really good job in that. And, you know, when I was a kid, I actually I had two sightings, but the first, I was like 11 years old, and me and my best friend who lived next door, the one actually who visited me at the moment of his death on the even my 21st birthday.
Right.
You know, this was 10 years prior. We were 11, and we saw one like up close. I mean, it was right over our heads. You know, maybe 30, 40 yards high. And it was big, and it looked just like, and I'm much older than you are. So, but we had a TV show on at the time called Lost in Space. And it looked just like the spaceship from Lost in Space. It was round, and about one-third of the diameter, and the underneath were all these multicolored lights that were swirling around, you know, and the thing kind of came to a standstill above us and then sharply darted about maybe 40 yards southwest and then sharply darted another 80 yards northeast.
Wow.
And then kind of jetted away. And we were having this big argument. We really didn't argue much at all. This was a big one. I don't even remember what it was. But I will tell you that it certainly ended the argument. We were so stunned, you know. It kind of like, it was kind of like President Ronald Reagan back in the 80s.
Right.
Who really started a program for space defense because he had seen a UFO in his youth and took it very seriously. And among our U.S. presidents, really kind of out there with his having seen one more so than most any other president.
And, right.
And he really made a very good point. Was that, you know, if it comes to the point where we learn truly that we are not alone, when there is a disclosure of some kind, or we get a visitation that is public and international, then, you know, I think that it could unite us as an entire planet, you know, rather than a series of nations that have these little beefs betwixt each other, you know. And I like that he said that, because it really did make the point.
Yeah.
And back then, Mikhail Gorbachev, who was leading the Soviet Union, back when it was, and really they ended the Cold War, these two gentlemen, Reagan and Gorbachev. And in Russia now, we call it, I guess, they've been very vocal about their UFOs.
I'm glad you said that, because I was actually going to say that. Yeah, they're so big into their in UFO investigation. Like, they're, like you said, they're so vocal. They're not afraid to, be public about it, so to speak.
Yeah, maybe there's one right outside, because it's, I hear sirens.
Yeah, maybe one crashed in my backyard.
Hey, you never know. But I think in a lot of the research that I've done over the years, it seems like the United States and England are really the two countries that are really reserved about it, you know, and Mexico and South America and Russia. They're just the opposite. They're very vocal about it. You know, they distinctly believe there are some 50 different species of extraterrestrial that are known to us.
Yeah.
And a guy in Canada not long ago, who was the Minister of Defense at the time, actually come out in the middle of a parliament session and state that he knew for a fact that there's at least 20 different species of extraterrestrials. He says they are in league with the major governments, and really have been since not long before the Roswell crash in the late 1940s, and says this has been going on for a long time. A lot of the governments have these deals with them where we're trading the opportunity to reverse engineer their spacecrafts with allowing them to abduct some of our people at random. And of course, you know, I can't prove that, but I can at least prove that this Minister of Defense said so, because it was in Parliament and they did make it public.
Yeah.
And it makes you think, you know, it really does.
Yeah, definitely. Me and Tim always say this, you know, a few times on our show, like whenever we get into the subject of extraterrestrials and aliens and UFOs and whatever, but the universe is just so big. And, you know, like in the beginning, like when space exploration was becoming big, or you know, just starting out, like we had no idea like how big the universe really was until now. Now they're like, you know, exploring like planets that could be like four times the size as our
own. Oh, yeah, the exoplanets.
Yeah, the exoplanets that they're discovering that can hold signs of life. And, you know, I mean, I would just, you know, I think it's like, how do I say it, naive of us to kind of say that we're the only ones in the universe.
Well, you would think so. But at the same time, you know, and see, I'm right with you on that point. I have seen cosmologists or astrologers. Or is it astronomers? The ones in space, not the ones with the horoscope. I always get too confused. I think that's astronomers.
Astronomers, right?
Yeah, and cosmologists who are, you know, looking at space, you know, 24/7, and finding all these different exoplanets or discovering that there is water. I mean, like H2O, water. On many of moons in our solar system, moons in Jupiter and Saturn, and seeing that, you know, some of these moons could be mostly water and have a surface of ice, and some of this water sprays off into space, and it would be hard to imagine that they could have all that water and no microbials, you know, or even oceanic life, that is intelligent enough, you know, to reach out into outer space themselves. And maybe they're camping out in our oceans, because we really haven't explored our oceans much. I mean, the pressure is pretty heavy, so it's very hard to find anything that can really go deep down into the water. and examine these types of things, you know, and I mean, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, look at the way our technology is advancing. You know, who knows how far we can really explore the ocean in the future. You know, we don't know what exploration is going to advance, you know, with that kind of technology. But what was I going to say? There's another theory that's out there, Chip. I don't know if you heard about this one, but they were debating if Mars was, well, scientists and NASA believe that Mars was once like Earth, you know, full of water, full of oceans, and, you know, it was basically a sister planet like Earth, only they believe that perhaps maybe there was nuclear weapons that destroyed the planet to make it kind of dismal and, you know, the red dusted planet that it's known as today.
Yeah, or they're doing the same things that we're being warned against, especially proponents of the global warming.
Yeah,
messing with the greenhouse gases, and that's our protection from this very high degree of radiation that's coming from our sun. You know, that without this magnetic belt that surrounds our planet, you know, we could be completely hammered with this stuff. And if we lose the ozone layer, we'll be just like Mars or Venus, incidentally, which also is believed, at least theoretically, to have also been a planet capable of water and mountains and life. You know, I think Mars gets more of that reputation because it's between the two, between Mars and Venus, it's a little bit more stable. It seems like maybe if we could create some carbon dioxide and build it up and create an atmosphere on Mars, it would be, again, habitable. And lots of theories they call panspermia, where we were created, or life on Earth was created from somewhere outside of Earth. Could have been from an asteroid or comet hitting Earth and creating, you know, this carbon-based life. I mean, there. Yeah, but they did find evidence of water, and by mistake, it was one of those rovers, right? And the names all sound the same. And again, I can't keep the Explorer, and then there's and they got all these different names. But the current one, the one that's running around there now.
Oh, Rover.
Rover. kind of. It was, a mistake being a blessing in disguise. I think the apparatus broke or did something wrong, and by doing so, they found soil with evidence of maybe 0.3% water.
Right.
And they think, well, maybe there's water underneath the surface that we can't see, and perhaps even more so, life underneath the surface, like deep down,
right,
where we couldn't see unless we were really on there. Part of the mission to where these people are willing to sacrifice the rest of their lives, or at least lives as they're familiar with, to fly out there and be the first humans, you know, to cohabitate on Mars.
Yeah,
that's one of the reasons for their going. And maybe to see if they could find any kind of evidence of subterranean life there.
Here's a good question for you, Chip. I'll probably ask James also. Where do you think we'll find solid proof or irrefutable proof where, you know, you can really say, you know, we believe that this is extraterrestrial? Do you think we'll discover it on another planet out in space, or do you think we'll actually discover it here on Earth first?
Neither. Out in space. But I think it'll be one of the moons first. I had a guest not too long ago, a couple of guests that were cosmologists, nationally known. That one guy actually really helped along the theory of cold dark matter and dark energy.
Right.
I mean, dark matter, they were talking about almost 100 years ago. I think it was Francis Zwicky coined the term, But we really have been getting into dark matter and dark energy and, you know, the kinds of energy that we can't see. And the one woman, cosmologist, asked posed a very good question, which is, what kind of extraterrestrial life would we accept? Would microbial extraterrestrial life be enough for us? Would it have to be some sort of humanoid types of thing?
Yeah, well,
like the Greys?
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, like, you know, do they always have to be like little green men or...
Right, right. I had a guest recently who suggested that these Greys actually have several bases on the moon, on the dark side. You know, when we first landed on the moon, Russians sent a capsule up there to outdo us. And they landed near the Sea of Calamity, which is near the dark side. It's portions where we're really not looking, you know. We're only really looking toward the sunny side, you know, where we can see stuff. But they tried to outdo us. They landed a capsule there. 3 days in advance, it didn't actually land. Something happened to it, and it virtually vanished. So they had to send another one about 3.5 years later. You know, it takes a lot of money to build these things.
Sure.
To try to find out what happened to the one that vanished, you know, because they were determined to steal our thunder, you know, when we first landed, to have something at least land there before we did in the United States. And second capsule that they sent also vanished. And to this day, they really don't understand. And it kind of maybe helps to answer a question which always captivated my curiosity, which is, why haven't we gone there since 1969? Why are we sending all these satellite type of, you know, non-human or robotic or satellite missions to Venus or Mars, or we're going to land on Pluto a couple of months from now. You know, July 14th, I think, is the set date. And we passed Ceres, which is nearby Pluto, and Mars, you know, or Jupiter. We've got all these different missions, but not the moon, or not sending people out to the moon, which is very nearby.
Yeah, that's a real funny question, actually, that come to think of it. Why aren't we going back?
Yeah. I mean, we certainly seem to have a lot of success. I mean, we've seen a lot of rockets there. We've seen a lot of manned rockets there. And then we just stopped. And it's been some 50 years,
yeah.
You know. And why? It's not like they're getting crushed by the radiation, or they died, or they came back all screwed up.
Yeah.
You know, no, I mean, you know, the first men to land on the moon, for the most part,
yeah,
you know, are still alive, and they're very well spoken, you know.
No.
It's not like they're mentally ill or, you know, have collapsed since they've been back.
Yeah.
So why? Cool. Why not?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's a very good question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it actually makes a little sense, you know, taken with a grain of salt to what a recent guest of mine claimed, which is these Greys have bases on the moon. That's why they're visiting so often and abducting people so often, or are well known. And then you got the bigger ones, the praying mantis-looking ones, which seem to be in charge of the smaller traditional Greys, you know, and there is a hierarchy there. They're thought to have function more like insects. There was even a report I saw recently that claims that if they are trying to create a kind of cross species between humans and Greys that we hear about in these abduction cases, one report assessed that it was because these Greys do not have a soul, whereas we do. You know, we have a belief in good and evil. We have a belief in an afterlife or resurrection or things like that. Depending on what faith you come from or what kind of things you look toward, many of us believe there is something that occurs to us after death, you know, where we, one way or another, continue on. And this report insists that that's what these grays are looking for, and that's really why they're trying to create a cross species.
Yeah, I would definitely not rule it out. Like I said, you know, I'm open to the idea of life being out in the universe other than Earth, because, like I said, I think would be naive to think we're the only ones here. And you know, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, there's so many theories out there that we can, you know, talk about. But my guest is standing by, but I want to, you know, for those who are just joining our show, once again, we're having a really awesome guest tonight. He's a very renowned UFO researcher. His name's James E. Clarkson. He considers himself a UFOologist, and he's the Washington State Director of the Mutual UFO Network, in Washington State. He's got law enforcement background, so he's a retired detective. And, you know, he works closely with prominent people in the UFO area. He works with Peter Davenport, the director of the National UFO Reporting Center, and William Puckett, the director of UFO SNW. And, you know, he's been doing this research a long time. He's worked with MUFON and a whole bunch of other stuff. And, you know, I'm really excited to have him. I can't wait to talk to him and get his debates on some of these theories. Possibly, maybe we'll talk about a little bit, and maybe he can shed some light on what he thinks about other life out in the universe and other planets, and, you know, all the other planets that we've been exploring. One of the big ones that I think we're really excited about, Chip, is Europa, being that it, I think, is full of ice and water, and I think they're gonna explore for, like you said, like the little microbes and, you know, like the little things.
Yeah, or oceanic life. And
yeah.
Enceladus, which is, I think, a Jupiter moon, if I'm... well, Saturn or Jupiter, it's one of those two.
One of them.
Europa is a Jupiter moon. And
I need to brush up on my astrology.
Oh, so do I, you know. But I just... yeah, there are so many moons on each of the giant gas planets in our solar system that I get confused myself. But, you know, yeah, lots of water. Or Titan, which is, well, I don't think it's water that they found, but they have discovered oceans of, the gas that comes out of garbage or waste. Methane, thank you. Like liquid methane, oceans of liquid methane. And you know, a lot of these cosmologists, you know, when they find evidence of methane, which they have on Mars also, it makes them think that there must be some sort of life involved, because most of the methane here is from waste of, you know, either animals or microbials, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I can't wait, you know, to see what kind of evidence they get with all these missions, and, you know, especially Mars. A lot of people have been so excited about Mars and the rover and all the images and everything that they've been getting from this little guy that's been, you know, roving around there.
Yeah.
Well, without further delay, Chip, I have my guest here, Mr. James Clarkson.
Excellent.
James, how are you? Welcome to Paranormal Talk Radio. I want to just first and foremost thank you for taking the time to being our special guest tonight. I'm a huge fan of your work, and a lot of other people are. You're respectable in the UFO field, and I don't know, you're a good guy all around. You know, you're well known, and you know, congrats to all your past work and up to date. And I don't know, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Matt. After a glowing introduction like that, I'll really have to work hard to live up to it.
So. We're excited because, you know, this subject has, you know, really caught some attention recently that we've talked about in private conversations before scheduling on our show. There's a lot of photos that have been released, you know, that are controversial. You know, their photos have been floating around, like we talked about, since the 1950s, which there's a big case that you brought up. The Trent photos it was one of the bigger ones. That you've been working closely with, and I don't know, James, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself, and we'll get right into things.
Well, I guess in a nutshell, I got my start in UFOs as a child. I'm of a generation where one of the movies that had a big influence on me was The Day the Earth Stood Still. Ooh. Not the version with Keanu Reeves,
right.
The original with Michael Rennie,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and Sam Jaffe, and it's still a classic. But I just kind of grew up always being interested in science fiction and UFOs, and everything happened because of a radio show for me, which is sort of ironic. But when I was a teenager, I got to hear a special radio broadcast where a brand new book was coming out called Incident at Exeter.
Hmm.
And at the time, it was all about UFO sightings in Exeter, New Hampshire. It was written by John G. Fuller, who, by the way, wrote the first really good book on Betty and Barney Hill also. Hmm. And I was totally fascinated because a lot of the key sightings that they were talking about were close encounters between on-duty police officers and civilians and very strange craft, like a giant disc 50 feet across with scintillating red lights that were going around its rim. And at one point during the sighting, the disc came down so low that an officer who was with a civilian witness pushed the civilian down on the ground. He knelt down and he started to draw his revolver just as a backup officer arrived who screamed at him, "Don't do it," which was probably good advice. And I mean, and then, of course, the Air Force turned around and said that he had seen stratotankers refueling in the night sky, and somehow he thought that that was a threat that would cause him to react as he did. I was completely fascinated, and I guess my life sort of followed parallel courses. On the one hand, I was always interested in UFOs, sometimes more than others, but on the other hand, I also pursued a lengthy career in law enforcement, which is what got me to where I am now and brought me to the Pacific Northwest, and it brought me to Washington State, and I've never regretted that choice.
That's really cool. And me and Chip, by the way, have so much respect for that.
Yeah, we do. We thank you for your service, both in the Army and in law enforcement. We cannot thank you enough. You know, it's a tremendous sacrifice, and we Matt and I absolutely believe it is just not honored and respected enough, but it certainly is here, and we thank you for that.
Well, I certainly appreciate that. I'm lucky because I was never in a combat zone, and I've only been in a few, probably a dozen or so over the course of 20 years, things that I would call really close calls during my police career. And fortunately, I came out in one piece, and
well,
I didn't have to do serious damage to anyone else. So I think all things considered, I'm pretty fortunate. The main thing is, I was thinking about this earlier because of thinking about Memorial Day, and I think about the deeper meaning. And for me, what it really boils down to is remembering people who keep their promises, because I don't think any of these people who end up, none of these people want to die in the line of duty or be seriously injured. They're just going out there and keeping the promise they made to take care of their comrades and the promise that they made to the people back at home. And, you know, people are always going out, thankfully, all of the unsung heroes in our society, policemen, firemen, paramedics, rescue workers. I mean, we could go on and on. There's lots of people.
Sure.
They go out and take risks so that the rest of us can have a decent place to live. And we forget that. We take it for granted.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you 100%. We definitely take life for granted and what we do for granted. There's not enough gratitude, like, going around, rather than, you know, you hear just mostly a lot of people complaining about what they don't have. Mm. And, you know, it should be the opposite of that.
Yeah,
no, you're right. But the getting back, kind of steering back towards
yeah.
where my passion is.
Sure. Yeah. Let's talk about the
seed got planted actually in a military police station at Fort Lewis, Washington, because I was a plainclothes MP. I almost never wore a uniform. And one night I was drinking coffee with the desk sergeant, and I looked down at his desktop, and he had a big piece of plexiglass with like 36 business cards underneath it.
Hmm.
And I looked down at this one particular card, and it said National UFO Reporting Center, 206-722-3000. And I said, "Sarge, what's that all about?" And he said, "That's where we report UFOs." And I thought, well, that's kind of different. And here I am in a military police station. Well, I remembered that number, and a few years later, in fact, it was quite a few years later, in 1986, if you go back through your UFO history, there was a really spectacular UFO sighting over Anchorage, Alaska, where a JAL airline pilot and his crew, they were it was a cargo plane, they were going into Anchorage, and they saw a huge UFO in the air. I mean, this thing was like, you know, bigger than an aircraft carrier.
Holy
with accompanying UFOs, small ones flying around it. And initially the FAA said, yes, we have it on radar. And then they said, no, we really didn't have it on radar. And that was after, of course, it broke in the media, and it caused a firestorm.
Sure.
Oh, sure.
And this was back in the day. I remember I sent in a letter to the FAA, and they sent me like a big manila envelope that had like 40 pages of really cool documents related to this UFO sighting. I still have it stuck away in a file.
Wow.
But I called that phone number and for the UFO Reporting Center, and a man named Robert Gribble, who was a retired Seattle firefighter, answered the phone, and I said, I don't want to report a UFO. I want to know how I can get off the sidelines. I want to be proactive. And he said, have you ever heard of MUFON? And that was a big event in my life, and that caused me to start going to meetings up in Seattle, and I met Peter Davenport, who still runs the National UFO Reporting Center. In fact, he was the master of ceremonies here just last week at the McMinnville, Oregon UFO Festival that I just got back from, which was spectacular.
Cool.
That's the coolest UFO festival. If you ever get a chance for some reason to be out in Oregon and you're there in May, you got to go to the UFO Festival. It is just, it's perfect the way it's put together because it's half serious and it's half for fun.
Oregon is on one of my bucket lists.
Oh, you got to. And the Oregon coast and all of that. But they have a huge parade. The entire town turns out for it. They had like 7,000 or 8,000 people lining the sidewalks. They have like floats that go on and on and on with rock bands on the back of a truck. And everybody's dressed like an alien. And, I mean, it's all for fun.
Is it like anything like the movie, if you've seen it, Contact, where they first went public with their finding at SETI, and the whole state looked like it ended up like throwing a huge rave party.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. In fact, they have an alien ball on Saturday night. It's sponsored by a company called McMinimans, and they do restaurant and hotel stuff, and they have an alien ball, and everybody drinks way too much in their alien costumes. But then they also have, you know, they had Stanton Friedman, Kathleen Marden, Travis Walton, and Grant Cameron.
Wow.
All giving lengthy presentations. And then they had this special luncheon that you could buy tickets for, and you would go in and sit down, and it was kind of like speed dating with a ufologist, because they could come and sit at your table for 20 minutes.
Wow.
And then they would switch off. So you got to spend 20 minutes with, like, one of these really awesome people and ask them a lot of questions and stuff. And I think they liked it, too.
Yeah.
In fact, I know they liked it because last year I was one of the speakers instead of just being one of the audience this time.
Cool.
Awesome.
I actually had Stan Friedman on our show not that long ago. And it was such a pleasure to speak to him, you know, over the radio, and just, you know, his knowledge and his experience that he has in the field, the stories that this guy has. And let me just say, this guy loves Project Blue Book.
Oh, yeah, he sure does. But it's nice, and we thank you, especially, you know, for somebody who's been such a tenured career in law enforcement. It really ups your authority, you know, which we thank you for. Stanton Friedman is a nuclear physicist, you know, it ups his authority. And we just personally, as fans of getting the truth out there, we love to see that sort of thing. So thank
you. When you address the question of ufology, you have to look at it at different levels. And, of course, the mainstream corporate news media, they only want to see tinfoil hats and little green men and all of that. They don't want to talk about someone like Stanton Friedman. They don't want to talk about somebody like me. They don't want to talk about somebody like Richard Dolan, who is a real academic historian.
Oh, right.
Who analyzes things that way and writes that way. And I can find you many people in ufology who have serious credentials because of their military experience, because of their law enforcement experience, or because they've come to this from other career fields. And it's sort of a bug. And once you catch it, you can't uncatch it.
That's true. One of the better bugs out there, we think.
Yes, yes.
How did your community kind of handle you kind of getting involved in UFOlogy? And did they respond well to you getting involved in this kind of research?
Well, I'm wondering if you mean like the community of law enforcement. See, I was a city policeman in a town out on the coast of Washington. This is a smaller county. It's like 50 miles west of where I am now. It's logging and fishing and, you know, a lot of very... In fact, the town where I was a policeman, the entire town was off limits for many years by the Armed Forces Police. It was one of the last places that had legal whorehouses.
Wow.
Yes, this place had a lot of history. I mean, if the walls could talk, they would say a lot down in that place.
I believe that.
The police chief who hired me told me on the day of his retirement with 25 years on the job, that was 1979, so he started 25 years before that. His first day on the job as a rookie policeman was as a bag man for the police department collecting the cut from the local houses of ill repute.
Wow.
So there's a lot of colorful history in Washington. We also have Bigfoot, and then we also tell people they came here first because we have the Kenneth Arnold sighting of June 24th, 1947, which was roughly a week or so before Roswell.
Roswell, right.
Now, of course, we could go back and talk about UFOs throughout history, but as far as, you know, classic United States modern ufology, it sort of started with Kenneth Arnold. You know, it could be argued that way.
Right.
Sure could be.
That kind of ties into one of the questions I was going to bring up, James, is out of all the cases in our country, you know, to date, you know, you've been in the field a long time, you know, even ones that you haven't researched yourself or ones that you have encountered personally. But out of all the cases, what stands out the most to you with your research and your opinion so far in the field in ufology?
You want the best cases?
Or the ones that really stand out for you personally?
Well, obviously, my friend June Crane, because she and I became friends. It wasn't just a matter of me investigating her. I didn't even really anticipate writing a book about her, except that she asked me to do that before she died. That opened doors for me because it gave me insights into that whole history of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, crashed UFOs, what they did with the bodies, what they did with the wreckage. So for me personally, that was powerful and remains very powerful. If I had to say what case, wow, there are a few cases that are extremely compelling. One of them in particular, because I just got to say hello to him again, is Travis Walton.
I love that story.
It's an amazing story. And in fact, now I haven't got the website handy, but did you know that there's a brand new movie made out about Travis's life?
No, the only one that I was familiar with was the other one that was out in the 90s, I think it came out.
Yes, that's mm-hmm. a terrible thing. He will tell you. He will tell you that. That's the first thing that he will tell you, is that Fire in the Sky has almost nothing. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you have to take Fire in the Sky, the movie, and break it into two parts.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the part on the ship, and the other one is the part off the ship. And he will tell you that almost nothing on the ship is correct. That's all Hollywood.
Yeah, but I believe that. Yeah.
You got to put it in perspective. His whole life was basically ruined and turned upside down because of the media firestorm that began while he was gone for 5 days.
Because
mm-hmm. you got to remember, he was gone. I mean, he wasn't even on the earth, in my opinion. I believe Travis Walton. I am also convinced, as a law enforcement officer, that the odds of Travis and all of his friends beating that criminal polygraph operator twice and maybe three times
mm-hmm.
in a row, the odds of six witnesses being able to do that to a polygraph operator are astronomical.
Yeah, sure.
Unfathomable.
What are the odds of that? Yeah.
Yeah, and this guy, he wasn't being paid. He's not on the crew. He's not getting royalties from the movie. He's a cop. You know, he was a career cop who ran a polygraph, and he got assigned to interview Travis's friends first, and later on Travis and his friends. And the only guy who didn't pass the polygraph the first time was the one guy who had a police record, and it wasn't that he didn't pass the polygraph, it was that he didn't cooperate with the polygraph operator.
Yeah.
Which is a different thing.
Yeah, I think that part of the movie, I think, kind of was accurate, because they kind of did that in that movie.
They did, and they got that right. And the business of law enforcement almost charging his friends with his murder, they got that right. The whole interaction with the community, and the fact that while Travis was gone, that news story went around the world. Travis told me, he said he couldn't even have a telephone for like a decade.
Hmm.
Because, you know, I mean, it's one thing to tell nice people about your story, but if you had to constantly be stopped by people who wanted to hear your story, and some of them are not so nice, or some of them are just nuisances.
Right.
You know, eventually you get kind of tired of it.
Yeah, it's more of a curse than a blessing, you know.
Exactly.
To have those,
and he didn't ask for this, and I really respect Travis Walton, because it's like he said, this thing damaged his life so much, this experience that he didn't ask for, other than that he went out and hooped and hollered underneath a UFO when it started up, but he said he figured he may as well make something good out of it. So he's tried to turn this into something educational for people. Mm. And when you meet Travis, I mean, in 2010, well, actually, I got to sit down and talk with him this time, too. But in 2010 in particular, myself, Travis Walton, and Colin Andrews were the presenters at McMinnville, Oregon. And I got to have several meals with Travis and really get to know him. And I realized that this guy he's what you see is what you get.
Mm-hmm. Yes, humble guy.
He's very humble. He's very polite. He's very nice. His story never changes. It is what it is. His reflections on it, I mean, he's had years and years to think about this. Originally, he felt kind of hostile about the whole thing. And now he's come to realize that perhaps they saved his life. In other words, this may have been, they weren't trying to abduct him because they wanted to probe him or anything. They took him up in the ship because he was almost killed. And probably if they hadn't, he wouldn't have survived.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't really know about that. That's really interesting.
It's a different way of looking at it. By the way, I want to plug this movie that I got to see down there in Arizona, and I've seen it several times since. It's called Travis Walton. It's called Travis, the true story of Travis Walton, and it's TravisWaltonTheMovie.com.
Oh.
And it is a very detailed, very insightful view of the whole Travis Walton story.
Cool, I'm going to check it out.
Yeah, it's really good. It's very, very well done.
Yeah, because like I said, I was, at the time, for its day, Fire in the Sky Foot was well done. You know, I enjoyed the movie a lot because of the way they tried to tell his side of the story, so to speak.
Well, and they did to a degree, and actually they keyed off of the fact he has said that they, when they were putting that script together, you know, he had little or no control because basically he talked to one man who had to go to somebody else who had to go to somebody else in order to get to a level where they could make a movie that would actually show in theaters. In other words, to get somebody like James Garner to play the lawman and all of that, it took a lot of money. And when you put up the money, you get to call the shots. So they wanted it to be really scary when Travis went on the ship. But they based that partially upon some of Travis's feelings that he described, because he did wake up scared on the ship.
Wow.
Because he was in a strange place and the air was odd and he was in a great deal of pain and probably he had been under for a long time.
Right. I had asked Chip this question earlier in our show, James, but with your experience so far today, up until today, you know, with all the space exploration that NASA's getting involved with and even independent companies are now getting involved, you know, China's now involved, every country's trying to, you know, get involved in the space exploration. Do you think that we're actually going to get solid evidence of other signs of life in space or on our own planet?
I'd have to answer that yes and yes. I think they've already gotten the evidence. Their problem is how do they play it?
Right, right.
It is going to upset the apple cart.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Do you think it's going to cause a lot of chaos around the world?
It could. Okay, there's several reasons why. One of them is, okay, people always say, well, why are they keeping it secret? Well, one very good reason is every country that has alien technology from crashed UFOs or whatever is secretly afraid that some other country may not have crashed UFOs, but may already be cutting a deal with the aliens.
Right.
And everybody wants to weaponize the technology.
Mm-hmm.
They don't necessarily want it for good reasons.
Right.
They want it because they want to wipe out their enemies with it.
Yep.
And the other thing is the corollary to alien technology coming out into the public, it's going to be pretty much the death knell for the hydrocarbon fuel civilization that we have right now. In other words, petroleum will still be useful for many things, to make plastics, to do lubricants, to create lubricants, all of that. But it will not be the essential fuel for mankind to generate energy the way it is now, because almost by definition, you know, if these are advanced technology vehicles, they are being powered by an alternative power source. I guarantee you that your average UFO is not powered by a Vortec V8.
Oh, right, right. Well, just today I read an article about nuclear fusion, not nuclear fission, that they've been using thus far as an alternative, which also helps to weaponize, but nuclear fusion, which requires millions and millions of degrees, you know, to create these charged atoms that will fuse together, and it would save a fortune, but they're already looking at something like 2037 before they really have something like that in place. So already, you know, it seems that they're giving some 30-year leeway. But I think, and if we're talking about full disclosure, it almost seems as though they're, you know, if they're going to do full disclosure, how would they do it? Well, maybe they would gradually have all these stories. And as days go by now, almost every day you're seeing things about pyramids on Mars or something. So by the time they do come out to a full disclosure, people will already say, well, yeah, I could have told you that. Do you think maybe they're starting to gradually try to work toward a full disclosure of some kind, in your opinion?
Well, I don't think they're ever going to come out and say, oh, by the way, we lied to you starting back in 1947. That's not going to happen. Politicians do not do that. They will not do it.
No, they according could be, to them, they don't lie.
Right, right. They don't. I never lie, and I always tell the truth.
Right. Yeah, and we so buy into that.
Yes. However, I think what's going to happen is there's a number of forces that are in play. This is never going to be a simple us versus them, or today we have disclosure and tomorrow we don't have disclosure now, but tomorrow we will.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a process going on, and there's a number of groups that have got their hand in it. And one of the groups that may have their hand in it, of course, is the extraterrestrial intelligence, whoever or whatever that is. Because if I had to, sitting back and looking at, you know, 30 years worth of UFO reports and all the things that I've read and all the things that I've heard, if I had to try and generalize and say, what do I think's going on? I think that there's an intelligence that is gradually acclimating us to its reality, and we really are in the position of being small children or maybe young adults, and we're getting ready to put on our big boy clothes and maybe go out there and join the rest of the community, but we're going to have to prove that we're mature enough. And so far, we're not doing a really good job.
No. Historically speaking, we're abominable. I mean, we're ferocious. I mean, with our own kind and with all the other species on our own planet. So I mean,
exactly, and that's why I think they're scared. The other possibility, of course, is that they didn't just come out tomorrow. I think it would be socially devastating if highly advanced, technologically superior aliens were to appear tomorrow. It would really upset the apple cart.
Mm.
You know, and what happens if a lot of people in the oil industry suddenly don't have jobs? You know, you take a big sector of the economy and throw them out of work for any reason, aliens or otherwise, and you can create social chaos. We have a very complex civilization, and it's somewhat delicate, and it's based on certain assumptions about being able to work and earn money and being able to go to the grocery store and get food. We have division of labor. Almost none of us would be capable of surviving on our own.
Right.
You don't want to lightly tamper with the machinery that keeps all of that together.
Yeah.
And
even though I want the truth, I want it, you know, I want it bad.
Yeah, me too.
I think half the world does.
There was a line in the movie Men in Black, which actually made a lot of sense. You know, people as individuals are, you know, smart, capable, you know, and can do pretty well on their own. But as a collective, we're panicky, dumb, and you know, we frighten very easily.
Have you ever been in a riot?
I'm very, very happy to say no.
I recommend avoiding them. I've only been in a couple on the edges of it. I managed to get out. People are really like that. They're dangerous and they're unpredictable. And they when you take away all the rules, I agree. I don't trust human beings very much either.
Look at the Baltimore incident.
There you go.
Oh, yeah, I know, right?
That's a good example. Yep.
This is their own community where they work and live, and they're, you know,
and that's
completely
the sad
destroyed.
Thing that happens over and over again.
Yeah, it is, and it's very sad. I'm also sorry to hear that you had to be a part of a couple of them.
Well, one of them was inadvertent in downtown San Francisco during a huge anti-war protests. You got, this is a different era. This is
sure.
back when they had the draft,
mm-hmm.
and if you had an anti-war protest, you could literally put 100,000 people in the street.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, that was my generation, too.
Thing.
Yeah, I was 4 years away, and I remember, you know, entering into high school thinking, you know, watching some of my sister's boyfriends, you know, because their birthday just happened to fall on the day that they went in. And, you know, they didn't have a choice whether some of them really wanted to. And the irony is the guys that really wanted to never got drafted. You know, they ended up enlisting.
True.
But, well, you know, the
people. And I ended up enlisting because of a strange set of circumstances, too. I did it to try and get an opportunity, which turned out to work out quite well. I wanted to get into law enforcement, and it seemed like a quick road to that. And it turned out I was right.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Of course, it could have turned out badly if they would have sent me to places where people were shooting at me. But who knows?
Yeah. And
alternate universe theory.
Right. Kind of a big fan of that myself. I just, as an aside, I wanted to ask you, if you think, I see some documentaries. A friend of mine, Robert Miles, has a company called Time Stream Pictures. They make some documentaries, and he's had Travis Walton and Stanton Friedman and Richard Dolan and gentlemen like that. And you know, you watch these things and you go, oh my goodness, I mean. It's almost, you have to stand outside of your own self to see these things and say, wow, because if true, we have been absolutely lied to for a long, long time. But a lot of them have something in common, and I just for some reason am itching to ask you this, but you know, the magnetic zones like the Devil's Triangle or the Bermuda Triangle or other areas where there's a strong geomagnetic force that seem to correlate to a lot of UFO sightings. Do you see anything in that, personally?
I haven't here in this state, but I've never tried to track it that way. I can tell you that we do have an area in Washington State which there have been actually a couple of formal scientific studies showing that there are very strange lights that have been consistently seen down by Mount Adams, and also on the Yakima Reservation and other places like that, you know, documented going back a couple of hundred years. Now, the problem with that is, though, if you go and you talk to James Gilliland from eSETI, he has a ranch down there, and people come down there. He claims that he can control these lights and that they are actually extraterrestrial vehicles that he can call on and get them to appear. I don't endorse that. I don't not endorse it. I need evidence.
But
I try to be very careful about where I draw the line. In other words, if you want to speculate, I'll speculate with the best of them.
Right, I hear you.
It's just speculating.
What's the MUFON level for Washington State?
What do you mean level?
Well, we were talking to some people from Pennsylvania. They were given a MUFON level of 5, which means that the amount of sightings for any specific county in that state are unusually high.
I'm not sure about that, but that's probably because my problem is I don't have enough field investigators. I have lots of people who want to come to meetings, but not very many people who want to do any work, to be honest.
I know. Nobody wants to do the work.
Exactly.
Boy, I get that. I get that.
I am actively recruiting field investigators if there's anyone in Washington State listening to this who wants to help.
Hey, we might move out there, you know, and help.
Well, you would be welcome. As far as the number of sightings, the interesting thing about Washington State is, although population-wise, we are not that heavily populated compared to, you know, California, New York, other places like that. If you check every month amongst the 50 states, you'll find that Washington always is somewhere between like 12 or 14 from the top. We get probably 15 to 20 reports a month that people have actually sent to MUFON. Now, that's not truly representative for a number of reasons. One of them is there's what I call the iceberg effect. In other words, a lot of people may have UFO sightings, but they will decide, I'm not going to run a report that. I don't want anybody to know I saw a UFO. There's a lot of that.
Yeah, I believe
There's slightly less of it because of television now, and we are seeing more people willing to report.
Yeah.
However, there are two other really good places to report UFOs, especially out here on the West Coast.
I think you're partly psychic too, James, because that was going to be my question, but part of what you were saying. Where can people report like their sighting? Because I know each state like has a different...
Well, MUFON.com will take reports from anybody, anywhere, and they will try and do something with them. So if you're, and especially if you're in the 50 states, it doesn't matter where you are. If you're in the United States and you want to report a UFO, MUFON will take your report.
Right.
Same thing with the National UFO Reporting Center, which I told you about my good friend Peter Davenport. Now, he does not investigate them. He will post them. You know, if someone writes out a narrative, a good basic narrative, who, what, when, where, why, and how, you know, keeps it real tight and sends it to him, he will be glad to post it on his website. Another very good friend of mine who helped me with the best case that I had last year, which I would be happy to talk about, it's a stunner. I mean, as far as UFO cases go, it's really good. But it's Bill Puckett from UFOs Northwest. He's been a friend for many years. He's a retired weatherman. He worked for NOAA, I believe, for many years. And I love to work with him because if we need radar data, he's one of the few people who can actually write a FOIA request. In other words, you don't want to send them a request that says, I want all your radar data, because the agency that gets your request knows that you don't really know anything about radar. Okay? But when he writes them a request, his requests are like very technical and very tight because he knows all the equipment and he knows what they can tell him and what they can't tell him. So when he sends a request letter, he gets an answer, you know, and that's what we want.
Right. Speaking of radar, how do the air traffic controller people that work in the towers when pilots and you know, airplanes are reporting sightings of UFOs, how do they go about you know, reporting what they're seeing? And like, do they keep composure pretty well? Like,
I think these people keep composure. If they're any good at being air traffic controllers, they could keep the composure if the world was ending outside while they were, you know, because I mean, they, let's face it, that has got to be one of the worst high-pressure jobs there is,
is
being an air traffic controller.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, I salute those people. They got to have, like, nerves of steel.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you have to be very focused. You cannot be distracted.
Yeah.
And so I bet that they do pretty well. I don't think they get reported very often here. And I can tell you, for instance, and this is generally backed up by all of the literature, in the United States, it's a very bad idea for a commercial airline pilot to report a UFO.
Oh,
it can
right.
be career suicide.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I know a career airline pilot who actually was flying out of Dallas several years ago. He's got a fully loaded airliner filled with passengers. This is in the early evening. That's a very crowded airport. Most of these big airports are very crowded now. I mean, you know, you say, when are they not busy? They're always busy.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the number. There's a map you can get on the internet if you want to get blown away. Look at the number of airplanes that are flying at any one time.
At any given time. Oh,
that
yeah.
They're taking people from point A to point B.
I actually saw one once when I was on a plane. Wrong time to look at that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think, how in the hell do they keep this straight?
Yeah, I know. How are there not that many more collisions than there really are?
Over by me, believe it or not, JFK Airport, which I'm not that far from, which is a well-known airport here in New York, just for some reason, the flight patterns have been, to me, very strange, that the flight patterns when they come to land or take off have really, like, they're, like, right above our neighborhood almost, you know, and it's, like, so loud, and it's, like, so many at, like, one right after another. It's, like, I'm, like...
I don't envy you that. That's out of the card.
Yeah.
But I'm just sitting here, like, are you kidding me? One just passed by a few minutes ago.
I'm sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
And but the thing is, so he's sitting here with this airliner getting ready to take off, and he tells me they've got like three big runways to go in different directions, and there's an area in the middle that is an absolutely restricted zone. No one is allowed to fly anything under any circumstances in that area between the runways.
Right. Yeah.
And you could sort of see why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not that's kind of a no-brainer.
Yep.
Well, they're sitting there, and he looks, and he sees a glowing orange oval-shaped object in this area. Wow. He not only sees it, but his flight crew sees it also. And they're kind of sitting there going, you know, with their jaws hanging down. And then this thing it looks like it has some sort of an antenna below it, and it looks like it's dropping balls of energy.
Oh.
Ooh. Meanwhile, they are moving in their pattern, waiting in line to take off. And at one point, he's reaching for the microphone, deciding whether or not they're going to call it in.
Right.
And these two guys, like, yell at him, even though he's the captain. And they
don't
said,
do it.
Don't do it.
Right.
Because for one thing, it was shut down the airport.
Right.
You know, post 9/11, if they call out something that.
Oh, yeah, even more so.
The airport.
Yeah, definitely.
So they went on about their business, and eventually it disappeared. But, you know, what did he see? He's absolutely certain he saw a UFO. His flight crew is certain he saw a UFO. He told me recently that he bumped into one of those crew members and asked him about it, and the guy just gave him a dirty look and, you know, basically said, I'm not going to talk about that.
Right. Yeah, because he doesn't want to suicide his career.
Exactly. That sighting that I mentioned back in 1986 with the JAL flight, I think it was Captain Taroshi, he was Japanese. He was basically grounded for almost the rest of his career because of that one incident.
Wow.
Because he made a report.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to add, though, ironically, if you're in Great Britain, they have a law that says that you have to report a UFO.
Oh, wow. I wouldn't have thought that.
If you're a pilot and you see something really weird in the air, you are required to report it.
So why do you think it's so different? Like, you know, like me and Chip, not to interrupt you, Chip, I know you're trying to get something in there, but before I lose this train of thought, we were talking earlier how, like Russia is, like, so, like, vocal about their UFOs and, you know, their investigations, and some other countries are very vocal about it, you know, and then, but yet you have the United States who, you know, like, it's a little more open than it used to be, but we're still kind of, like, hush-hush about it.
We're still froze out.
Yeah.
I don't think they've ever changed their policy, to be honest. I also believe that, I really do believe that starting in 1947, when they passed the National Security Act, and some people think that it's not a coincidence that they started work on the National Security Act in the fall of 1947, and it was passed early into 48, as I recall. Mm-hmm. The reason for that was it was in response to Roswell.
Mm.
You know, that was one of the reasons. And the fact, of course, that we were obviously going to be dealing with the Soviet Union in post World War II,
right, and, you know, and developing nuclear
politics.
Technologies,
yes.
Also, yeah,
yes, exactly.
We were talking earlier before we were fortunate enough to bring you on about the kind of risk it really takes for somebody to come out and say, well, you know, I was abducted or I saw a UFO, and especially for pilots, but. It makes it all the more mind-boggling, and I'm very curious about this because you have a book about it now. How did it come out where June Kram, who had some very specialized knowledge that she was sitting on, how did that meeting come about, and who asked who first? Because we both really understand the enormous kinds of risks, especially back then, that it takes to come out and say, well, this is some of the stuff that I know, and... et cetera. How did that start?
Well, you got to kind of put it all in historical context. I first met her in 1993. I do a lot of public outreach. I do lectures on UFOs any place I can get an opportunity. In fact, I'm doing one in Seattle here very soon. I was doing one at the Ocean Shores Library, which was the same place where June lived. June was very well known in the community. She showed up for the lecture. When it was all over, she approached me and said, "You're right. The government knows all about UFOs and they're keeping it a secret." And I could tell from my experience with people,
mm-hmm.
you know, you deal with people in a lot of different ways when you're a policeman.
Oh, sure.
I knew that this woman was stone cold sober, absolutely serious, and that there was nothing crazy about her at all.
Right.
And so I said, "Well, tell me more." And she said, "I can't. They'll come and arrest me." And I think she was sort of looking at me because I didn't keep it a secret that at that time I was still a active police officer. In fact,
mm-hmm.
I was detective sergeant.
Were you in fraud at that time?
Oh, sure. I was detective sergeant. We would take whatever cases came in. I worked fraud constantly. But when you're in a small city, we had 36 officers. You got to be a multitask detective. You got to know how to do a lot of things.
Sure.
And I was the detective sergeant. Well, and so on my off-duty time, I was giving this lecture. And I got her name and whatnot. I gave her my business card. I said, "Please, if you ever change your mind, call me." Well, now we got to flash forward to 1997, which was a big year. We have the Phoenix Lights in March 13, 1997,
oh, right.
which is the largest mass observed UFO event that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly for the United States.
Yeah, for us. Yeah.
And then you have the 50th anniversary of Roswell that 4th of July weekend.
Oh, true. Nice.
So the Air Force is now caught in kind of a bind. What are we going to? We are in a bit of a pickle here. The public is not really buying the, "Oh, we just dropped flares over Phoenix" explanation. That was not, that
weather
was not selling well to thousands of people who actually saw it.
Right.
You know, it did okay for the outlying areas, but not for the people who were actually there. And, of course, we had Fife Symington, who did his little news thing with the one of his aides dressed up in an alien suit.
Well, that sure didn't help.
I know. I hated Fife Symington at the time, but he redeemed himself in 2007.
I can't see why.
Well, he actually admitted that he saw the UFO.
No kidding.
Oh, yes. You can get the videotape off CNN. Look up Fife Symington UFO, and you will get him admitting in 2007, a decade later, that he saw the UFO and basically, and bear in mind, this guy was a fighter pilot in Vietnam and a captain in the Air Force, and he said that he was convinced that the technology was not from this earth.
Wow.
So, I mean, and that got very little news, but it's a fact. It's
I believe it got very little news.
Yes, they're not going to emphasize that.
No, there's no sensationalism there.
Yeah. Back to 1997, the Air Force decided, by coincidence, we're now going to issue our final word on Roswell. So they wrote that book called Roswell, Case Closed, and, of course, it got maximum publicity on CNN. Well, it backfired in an enormous way in the case of June. My friend June was now 70 years old, and her cancer was coming back. She didn't tell me that. I kind of figured it out later. And I found out about it later. But she was watching the CNN coverage, and she called me on the phone. And in fact, she didn't even introduce herself. She said, "It's a damn lie." And she started in about the balloon. She said, "That was the same story we used to use when I worked there and people wanted to report UFOs." And she started in on me telling me all these things. And I said, "June, am I understanding right that you now want to talk to me?" And that's when she said something I'll never forget. And that will answer your question. She said, "I'm 72 years old. I've outlived two husbands and my cancer's in remission. What are they going to do, shoot me or put me in prison? I can do either one."
I guess so.
Well, see, so I think she kind of knew that her cancer was, you know, probably going to come back.
Oh, that's so sad.
Well, I wasn't born yesterday, so I said, when can I come to your house?
Mm.
And so I started going out. She was a night owl, and I started going out after work and driving to her house, and we would stay up half the night drinking coffee, and she would tell me about her life at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And it wasn't just her telling me about UFO-related stuff. I was fascinated because talking to her, it was like being in a time machine.
Mm.
I got to hear about everything, what it was like to work in an office environment like that. I mean, this, of course, is back in the day of typewriters. Now, there's a ancient device.
Oh, I know them well.
Yes, yes, me too. Well, in her office, when you went home at night, they would take you had to take the ribbon out of your machine and put it in a safe.
Oh, wow.
And she was in charge of safes. That was her job. You got to remember, this is pre-computer, no internet.
Right.
So people want to work on top secret projects. They have to check the file out from somebody. That would be June. And in order to get a file, you had to have the correct security clearance, and you had to have a need to know. So see, she had a very important job, although she wasn't a member of the military. She was a civilian employee. But she had to have the same security clearance in order to handle that kind of material.
Wow.
So that spoke to her character. But that's my answer to your question, is that people decide for personal reasons when enough is enough.
Right.
And they decide, I don't care what the consequences are. I know what I saw. I know what I did. I know what I experienced. I am just going to tell people, and if that's a problem, it's a problem. That's the kind of impression I've gotten from the most convincing witnesses, is that they just reach a point where they can't stay silent anymore.
Yeah,
and good for them, because like we've said over and over, it's so hard to come forward about this information, and especially depending on, you know, the type of job you have or what field you're in, you know.
And who would have a better BS meter than a fraud investigator?
Well,
I'm a little jealous of that, actually.
I was very lucky because the thing, I knew what to look for in June, so I had to kind of like, you're a little schizophrenic when you're a detective. I have to admit that. Because you're talking to the person, but at the same time, you're carefully evaluating them.
Right.
If that makes sense. Because
it's in your blood now to
do
that.
It's a habit of many, many years.
Sure.
30 years, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. Well, we're actually coming down to the wire. I can't believe how much time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Boy, that flew by.
Wow. Yeah. But, James, you know, it's been an incredible show having you on our show. I can't tell you how much fun this interview has been. And, you know, some interviews are really tough. You know, some are more fun than others, as we know, Chip, right?
Right.
But I have my utmost respect for you, just, you know, from your years of experience researching, you know, this subject. And again, you know, with your background and expertise, you know, I can't thank you enough. And are there any, you know, before we, you know, say our goodbyes, but are there any upcoming events or projects or anything you'd like to plug real quick, you know, anything that's happening in the works?
Well, I'm constantly investigating cases. Like I said, I am giving a presentation in Seattle for they call it the Seattle UFO Network. I haven't set a date yet for the next local meeting. I'm always looking for other presentation opportunities.
Will that be on JamesClarksonUFO.com, like your book?
Yes, it will be.
Awesome.
Thank you for doing that. I was hoping we could work that in here somewhere.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm going to get myself a copy. I'm looking forward to that. And
too.
There was one thought I would like to insert in here real quick if there's time.
Yeah, sure.
Please.
This is an American philosopher named William James. Mm-hmm. And this thought, very short, I just love because it applies so perfectly to UFOs. In order to disprove the assertion that all crows are black, one white crow is sufficient.
That's great.
And see, that is so perfect because one of the things that riles me the most about mainstream media handling UFOs is that they put the entire subject goes on trial over each case. And I would just add, my final comment would be, if we had more time, we could discuss the Roswell slide fiasco. That is not Roswell.
Right.
Ooh, wow.
Good or bad, that is not the Roswell investigation.
Wow. Well, we'd definitely love to have you on in the future. This subject is a very popular subject, and if we keep in touch, I'd love to schedule you again in the very near future.
Please do. I love doing these. I get a big kick out of them. It's fun, and hey, you never know what you're going to come up with. No. You never know, there could be another June out there.
Yeah.
That's what I really want. That's what I want most. That's on my wish list. I want another person who has something really important to say that might not get properly told if they don't find the right listener.
Yeah, you never know who's listening. Yeah.
Here's hoping serendipity strikes twice.
There you go.
That was a great way of putting that, Chip. James, I want to thank you. Again, as always, we appreciate it. And you've been a great guest. And I look forward to staying in touch with you. And, good luck to your future endeavors and your projects. Best of luck to you with everything. And I hope you have a great weekend and Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, we'll be thinking of you. And thank you for your service again.
Yep. Well, let's do this again.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So
thank you very much, both of you.
All right.
It's our honor. Thank you.
Yeah, our honor. Have a great night.
You too.
All right. Yeah, bye-bye. Wow.
Wow.
I'm really, really impressed with Mr. Clarkson.
What a guy. James Clarkson, UFO.com.
Yeah.
It's all one word, of course.
I'm glad you threw that in there, Chip.
All the information that you need to know, the book, upcoming events, radio, TV, his blog, all about him.
Yeah.
Great stuff. Wow, what a guy.
Yeah, that was a really fun interview. It was like one of the most fun interviews I've had in a while.
And it blew by.
Yeah, they always do. When you enjoy the interview, I don't know about you, Chip, but I find that's when the time really flies.
Oh, I know. Yeah, it goes way too fast.
Yeah. But at the end of our show every week, we usually plug our announcements, upcoming events and stuff like that. Chip, are there any events you'd like to share with our audience?
I have a show Monday nights on Dark Matter Radio Network. Art Bell returns to our network on July 20th, which is a Monday. So I'll be lead in to Art Bell. My show is Understanding the Fringe. I have a very special episode coming up this coming Monday on autism. Susie Miller, who has a program called Awesomism. Dr. William Tiller, who has been great in the field of physics, and he's working with her. And filmmaker, actor, and director Michael Shabrassi, who's making this very special film about it. All will be my guests. 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern this coming Monday. On Dark Matter Radio, which is darkmatterradio.net.
Cool. And we're actually starting in June, Chip. I don't know about you guys, but we're going to start promoting the big event that's going to happen October 17th with Chris DiCesare.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
We're going to all be lecturing there together.
Yeah. I can't wait for that. I'm so excited. You have no idea.
Oh, yeah, I know. But plus, we'll get to hang out in person again.
Yeah, and that, to have that on top of everything is just amazing. And yeah. John Colvin is going to be there.
Yeah.
You guys are going to be reuniting once again.
Yep. The Keeping the Spirits Alive team we're lecturing together, actually. So
yeah.
It's John and I together.
Yeah.
And Matt is lecturing. Dave DeLeese will be lecturing.
Alan Lewis
will be lecturing, who's an absolutely wonderful human being. And all in honor of Krista Cesare, speaking of absolutely wonderful human beings, the 30th anniversary of his C2D1 haunting, which took place in 1985 at SUNY Geneseo, which is between Rochester and Buffalo in upstate New York.
Yes, we're actually going to have Krista Cesare as a guest June 5th. So
nice.
Yeah, we're going to have him kickstart our promotion for the event. So that would be a nice way to start things off.
Yeah, sure would.
Of course. And our next guest is going to be, we're going to have our next I Am Kenny Biddle segment. What I do want to announce to our listeners is that we really want to try to get our listeners to maybe participate in this show, because we're going to do a special segment about the technology that's used in the paranormal field. We want to get people's opinions and views on the current technology and methods used with this technology, what works, what doesn't work for you. We want your opinions, because there's a lot of opinions out there about the technology.
There sure is. I'll give you one. Anybody who uses phone apps to find ghosts is no good in my book. That's all I got to say about it. That's my pet peeve.
I like that. yeah, I concur with that as well.
Thank you. Thank you, good brother.
But, yeah, it's going to be a really cool episode, because we want our listeners to try to get involved with us. And you can call in. I'm going to announce our number over the air. It's 646-787-8160. That's the number to call in. And, again, it's 646-787-8160. And that's the number to call in. Again, we want your opinions about the technology in the field, what you think works, don't work. And me and Kenny are going to talk about all that kind of stuff. So we're going to break technology down, what it does, what it's meant to do, what it's not meant to do, and all that good stuff. So that's going to be a great show. That's going to be next Friday night.
Outstanding.
Yeah, I can't wait. And I think that's – oh, and another special announcement I want to make. I want to announce to our listeners that I'm actually going to be filming a new documentary, Chip.
Oh.
I'm going to be filming Attachments. Attachments have been brought up in conversation a lot lately, and it made my brain click a little bit. And, you know, being that I had an experience myself, and a lot of other people I'm sure has a lot of experience with attachments and spirits following them. And but this film is going to be a little bit different than what I was trying to achieve. I want to film investigators that feel that have an attachment, because I can't imagine the amount of investigators that go into an investigation that may feel that, you know, they bring stuff home with them. And, you know, I kind of want to film not only their experience, but I want to try to help them on top of it because of my own experience, and try to help them, you know, with sharing my own experiences with them to try to offer them help in that way, to try to maybe have a better understanding of their situation. And I think that would make a great film, and I'm looking for volunteers in the New York tri-state Long Island area, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, basically anywhere in the New York, Long Island tri-state area. And if you'd like to volunteer, if you think you're having an attachment and like to participate, and, you know, at the same time, I can try to help you as much as we can, that's my goal.
Wow. What a great project, brother. This is first time I've heard of it, and
yeah.
I think that's great. I have an attachment to you, aside from that, and, of course, my lovely wife. Aside from that, never happened to me, very happy to say. I should mention quickly, I'm involved in a documentary called Afterlife Uncovered. It's a kind of a big thing. It's not mine, but I've been asked to kind of be an ambassador for it. AfterlifeUncovered.com is the website for they're actually utilizing footage and audio and things of that nature that will prove the existence of an afterlife. And there is a TV show associated with that somewhere down the road. Not sure if I'm involved in that at all. But if you believe that you have footage or audio that you really think may help to prove the existence, we're not talking simple evidence, prove the existence of an afterlife, then reach out to them at afterlifeuncovered.com or reach out to me on Facebook at Chip Reichenthal and just send me an instant message. Or Matt.
Message as well. You guys can email me at paranormaltalkradio@gmail.com or islandparanormalsociety@gmail.com. And, that's our show. I think it was a great show, Chip.
Wow, fantastic as always, brother. God bless you.
Yeah, thank you for, filling in for Tim.
Thanks for having me. It's always an honor. It really is.
Well, it's an honor to have you. You know, like I tell everybody, Chip's my mentor and a good friend of mine. And you know, I can't imagine this world without you, man.
I feel the very same about you, brother. And we get to see each other in October, which is great. Maybe even before that.
Yeah.
Now that I got my car back. Yeah.
That's awesome, man. I'm glad you did. So, all right. So I'm going to end the show. I hope everybody has a great Memorial Day weekend.
Absolutely.
And as always, be safe. Do everything that you do safely. I know it's a big party weekend for some, and just remember that it's about celebrating. What James said. It's celebrating. The meaning of what you do, and it's about our veterans that sacrifice themselves and. And all that good stuff. So
Don't get carried away and do it in a way that ends up having us memorialize you, please.
Yes, definitely. So have a good weekend, everybody. Chip, if you want to stay on, I'll say goodnight to you.
Okay.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
We'll see you next time.
Thank you for tuning into Paranormal Talk Radio. We broadcast live every Friday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio. Don't be intimidated by the hosts. We would love to get your feedback about our show, whether it is good or bad. You can leave comments on our Blog Talk webpage or email us privately at paranormaltalkradio@gmail.com. Would you like to interact with other listeners or the host during the show? Register free with Blog Talk Radio to chat with us live during the show. You can also look us up on Facebook. Answer questions and polls and get the latest news. Until next time, see you on the other side.
Alrighty, we are...